Christian, are you going to sell us something here, or? It's our second-hand car salesman is here.
I'll try to describe the product. Thank you.
Good afternoon. In January of this year, the boards published an exposure draft on offsetting of financial assets and financial liabilities. The comment period ended 28th April 2011. We so far received over 160 written comments. In addition, the staff conducted outreach and we spoke with our preparers, users, regulators, auditors, and clearing houses. We've also conducted an online survey for users to determine which approach they prefer, whether to see net on the face or gross on the face. In addition, the boards held three roundtables, one in London, one in Norwalk, and the other in Singapore. Agenda Paper 5 and the Appendix 5A sets out or provides a summary of the feedback we've received, both in terms of comment letters and also from the outreach that the staff conducted, and also from the roundtables. The paper does not set out a comprehensive analysis of the issues raised in the comment letters and what we had on our outreach. But we provide a summary here, and we believe as you decide which way you want to go, we'll bring back a more detailed analysis of the issues raised in the comment letters. The paper also sets out a broad some broad possible approaches that the boards can consider as a way forward. And so we want to split our today's discussions into two sessions, one to discuss comments on the comment letters, from the comment letters and also from the outreach, but the second also to ask you for direction so that the staff can then go away and work to provide you with the comments and analysis that you might need to make a decision going forward. On the comments, there were some very general, I'll say, issues or themes that we can probably focus on. The first one, which is, I'll say probably almost everybody said it, that they applauded the boards for the direction, i.e. Working towards convergence in this particular area. Almost everybody agreed that there is a significant difference between US GAAP and IFRS numbers because of this particular, the difference in the guidance on offsetting. And so they're recommending that the board should, at all costs, work towards convergence in this area. As we well know, even before we published the ED, there was mixed feedback from users. Some preferred net on the face, others preferred gross on the face. But irrespective of their preferences, they all believe that both the net and the gross number will tell them a different story, and they need both numbers. We also had a different type of netting. Some prefer net based on market risk. Some prefer net based on credit, but different type of credit net numbers. So the feedback was quite mixed. We didn't have a consensus from users. And even between U.S. users and also international, I would say, outside the U.S., there was no consensus. And at times we would sit in a room talking to users from a particular organization, and they will have different views. So it's not really consistent across, even within organizations. Regulators were more, outside the US, almost all the regulators that we spoke with or sent comment letters were in support of gross presentation. They also believe that the disclosures will be very helpful. I would say in particular, the prudential regulator in the US supports net presentation, as you might have seen from their comment letter. Preparers were also divided. Some supported gross presentation. Others support net presentation. But overall, they also applaud the work towards convergence in this particular area. Some felt that I-32 provides the best answer. Some believe that the U.S. GAAP approach is the way to go. And I think it's just for everybody you speak to, you have a split even among auditors. So that's a general, at a very high level, feedback from the proposal. I would say in general, some support the criteria in the ED, subject to addressing issues like collateral, variation margin, simultaneous settlement, and also the units of account to which you can apply the offsetting guidance. So without going too much into detail, I'll turn it over to the boards for us to discuss comments arising from the ED, and then we can discuss a possible way forward.
Okay. On the comments. John?
What's the reason for the passion? I mean, I got a comment at the outreach that they'd rather not have convergence than as long as they get their answer. What's the passion here?
I'm not sure how many respondents or how many constituents that you spoke with, but I'll say generally, maybe over 90% of respondents preferred convergence or said, well, convergence is very important and the board should work towards that. There are some who believe that the right answer is more important than convergence. So if it means you don't get convergence and you still get the right answer for whatever guidance they're applying now, they will prefer that.
So that would be the next question. What's the right answer?
We all agree with that.
Okay, Tatsumi?
Oh, thank you. Christian, so one thing which I'm not clear is cash collateral. So I think my educational understanding of the central clearing house is say once the collateral is different from the sort of the right and obligation related to the transaction, but say in most cases the people, especially the derivatives case, and they keep telling us that it's a partial settlement, but say it might be depend on the legal system or the requirement by the CCP, I think. But say, I would like to know what the difference is the treatment of the cash quota.
The staff is planning to hold an educational session on a variation margin and collateral and simultaneous settlements. But it is fair to say that there are many different arrangements that we've seen both in the OTC world, over-the-counter trades, and also the exchanges or the central counterparties are not the same. They all have different systems and different ways of treating collateral. So I think if we were to go into it right now, it's going to take a bit of time, but we're planning to hold an educational session on that, just for collateral and units of account and simultaneous settlements.
So that means in our ED, I think that to have the collateral is different from the settlement, but it might be the case where that our proposal does not meet, might happen. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it is fair to say some collateral, there are different types of collateral, but in general you have one that the counterparty can only attach in default or in bankruptcy. There are other systems where the collateral or the amount you're paying as collateral might be used as part of the settlement or might not be used as part of the settlement. So there are many different types of arrangements. And depending on the arrangement and the rights of the parties, you might probably meet the objective of the ED. And in some scenarios, you might not probably meet it. But we'll need to set it out in detail for you.
The basis for my question, I've seen different views on this, so I was wondering if the staff knows, and that's the impact that Gross' presentation would have on regulatory capital. I recently saw a thought piece from investors in the U.S. that says it would have no impact on regulatory capital, but yet at our roundtable, the prudential regulator in the U.S. seemed to observe that there was a significant impact. And to agree there is a significant impact, that may be some of the passion that John's referring to. But have you done any analysis to know what would be the impact both internationally and in the U.S. related to regulatory capital?
Well, I think it is fair. We've had a series of sessions with the Basel Committee or the Accounting Task Force of the Basel Committee. And their view is that if a particular jurisdiction is applying Basel II or even moving to Basel III, there will not be any impact on regulation at all because they have their own rules for calculating what a capital is and what your leverage should be, and it's not based on the accounting number. And hence, there will not be any impact. So if you take out most of the jurisdictions outside the U.S., we do not expect there to be any regulatory impact. But for the U.S., our understanding is that there is a regulation in place that says for leverage calculation, you need to take total asset number to calculate. And in practice, what they've been doing, or the regulators have done, is that they use the balance sheet number as a total asset number. Although the regulation doesn't specify what the total asset number is, that's what they've been doing. And hence, there will be an impact if they still depend on the total number in the balance sheet. But that said, they also admit that in the past they've done some adjustments or they've allowed some transition period. So we don't know what they're going to do with this particular guidance if it becomes final.
Okay.
But doesn't that mean that really is a jurisdictional issue and that it's within their power to deal with that impact? And that presumably from what you say, in the past they have had undertaken some adjustments.
Not of this order of magnitude.
But why?
They like
why,
to keep.
Why couldn't they, Leslie? If it requires some change to their regulations, why isn't that something that they could do? Why does it have to be linked to the accounting numbers? Right. I find it frustrating, actually.
Yeah. They certainly can. I mean, they have it within their discretion. The leverage ratio, particularly though, they like to keep it simple so that it's completely understandable to everyone. And they've made very minor adjustments to it. My understanding is over the years. And for something like this, the effect of adjusting the ratio would be to actually lower the ratio for most organizations when this type of activity, the derivatives and repos, is really concentrated in a very small number of organizations.
Isn't there also FDICIA or FERIA? I can't remember which one. FDICIA, right? Which there's a law, Warren, from Congress that says accounting regulations for purposes of prudential regulation cannot be less stringent than accounting, any less stringent than for financial reporting purposes. And so, yes, they have made adjustments in the past. Unrealized losses and gains on available for sale securities is one, for example. But to Leslie's point, this would be, a big one, and they would potentially think that they might have to get a law changed in order to make the regulatory change.
FDICIA says that in call reports, you can't have accounting that's more conservative, less conservative. However, that doesn't apply to regulatory capital. They can do whatever they want with regulatory capital. It's just that the base call reports have to be.
Presumably, we will continue to disclose both the gross and net after offsetting. So why could not they base their ratio on the net figure as published? If the law doesn't say gross total balance sheet, but balance sheet amount, balance sheet total, is there a big problem in using the net figure? I have a question. Do the U.S. regulators and the U.S. preparers recognize or accept the need for a level playing field internationally in the application or in the effects of the leverage ratio?
I think the U.S. is moving to, I believe, either Basel II or Basel III, one of them, but it's going to take probably about 2 or 3 years or so for them to move. So all that we're talking about here is an interim for the next 2 or 3 years that they are migrating to Basel II or Basel III. That'll be the effect. But that said, they said depend on how the balls come out, they will have to look at the guidance as to how they either adjust or whatever they will do.
So is that a matter of the effective date of our proposed standards? If we had an effective date aligned with whatever Basel II, Basel III application in the U.S., then we will solve the issue, I guess.
I think what we have to do first, though, is what do we think the answer should be? And then we decide what we're going to do if there's a clash with some jurisdiction.
But the guys.
John?
To me, David, that's the difficult. What should the answer be? At the round table I was at, someone threw out this notion of linkage. And I asked the bank preparer, the regulator, and the user that were there, what did they think? And they could agree with it, but without the parameters weren't defined. But why? Why is it that if you put it in the balance sheet, gross, and show the net, that's okay? But if you put it in the notes and do it one way or the other in a balance sheet, it's not. And it just, there's no answer to this, because it's the same information. But yet there's a concern about regulators, there's a concern about leverage, there's a concern about a lot of things, and it just it doesn't seem to make sense.
I think there's more to it. My personal take is that it depends on what the net number represents. I can take, for instance, any asset on the balance sheet, take any liability on the balance sheet, and present a net amount. I'm still showing a net amount. But what are you trying to convey with the net amount? And that information is very important. Depending on what the net amount is conveying, it might be important or it might not be important. But let's take an example, for instance. I have an asset of 70. I have a liability of 40. And the liability of 40 matures tomorrow. But the asset of 70 matures in 3 months, or let's say even a year. You say, well, if I net the two amounts, my exposure is 30, 40, and 70. But tomorrow, if I pay the 40, I'll be left with 70. So by representing that I have a net exposure of 30, I'm misleading all the people that are reading the accounts. So it depends on what the net number is. It might be meaningful or it might be a useless number, depending on what I take into account in arriving at the net number. And then the second question becomes, okay, what is your balance sheet supposed to do? Why do you have the balance sheet in the first place? And what are you showing on the balance sheet? And what does the total number on the balance sheet give me? So then you begin to, there are a whole range of issues, but I'm sure we'll come to that. We'll just discuss maybe the comments at this stage, but we'll come to the approaches later.
But just in response to your question, John, my suspicion, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that part of the attraction might be because the total asset outcome would be similar or the same as if you were netting. So if you're focusing on leverage, that probably gets them a long way to what their concern is. Assuming that the linkage was based on the US GAAP criteria. Well,
seems to me that there's no issue that on our convergence agenda on which we're starting from a more diverged position than this one. I mean, we're in complete opposite ends of the spectrum. And our existing standard, I think, before I get there, the second, I look, well, where do we get some guidance? So I go to our conceptual framework looking for presentation guidance, and there's very little. It just says you don't offset assets and liabilities, but it doesn't give you any other presentation guidance. But it does say, and then our other standards, IAS1 particularly, say the balance sheet presents assets and liabilities, not risk positions. And so I can understand, I mean, I would approach the solution to this problem. And I think most of our commentators have said, I want to know both pieces of information, but it seems to me the conceptual framework leads you in one very clear direction. And in the absence of any more specific guidance in our standards, I have to fall back to what's an asset, what's a liability. I'm also a little worried about a slippery slope. You can develop relationships between all sorts of things that are on both sides of the balance sheet. We were already in that area in leases. We're in that area on insurance this morning. It's basically a net presentation. Pensions were a net presentation. I don't know where we're going to end. Maybe I've moved beyond what the commentators have said to kind of what's leading me toward an answer, but it just seems to me of the three choices we have, gross, net, or linked, the only one I can find support for under our framework is a gross presentation.
What do you mean, assets and liabilities? Separately?
As we proposed in our exposure draft, as we have in IAS 32, and I also say, well, is IAS 32 really broken? And if it's not broken, are we going to break something by trying to
abandon it and move in a very different direction.
But then you'd have to say there's something broken about U.S. GAAP, I guess.
I certainly wouldn't imply or infer that.
We're not aware of any practice issues.
I suggested it when we were unable to even come up with an exposure draft. I just threw the term out. I said, well, you know, a possible compromise. Fortunately, we didn't need to go that route. And I thought we went the sensible route. And I personally would, I'm happy with the route we took.
Can I make another comment? It also seemed to me, being pure about this, that in our unsuccessful presentation project, there was a notion of moving assets and liabilities on different sides. So, I don't know what the right answer is.
Mark?
That's the question. It's been asserted by some that this is a critical game-changer issue for a small number of institutions and not as big a deal more broadly. You guys have done a lot of outreach, et cetera. Do you agree with that assertion, or how do you think about that? What's the broad impact?
I think it's just an issue of order of magnitude. Any institution that has got more than one derivative with the same counterparty will be affected by this proposal. But typically, in terms of volumes, you're talking about five big major players that will be affected by this. Others will be affected. Even energy industry are also very big players in the derivative market. But we think, yes, a few institutions, but it's not so much whether it's few or more, but what is the right thing to do and what's the right information to convey.
Well, there's a major level playing field issue among the large institutions.
Tom, you want to come in? Then Warren?
I was convinced at least of two major problems we had in the exposure draft. One had to do with simultaneous settlement and how that works for exchanges. I think that we did not think that through very thoroughly, and I think that we have a significant issue there that we can easily address. The other issue I think that was very important that gets in between the gross and the net is how we dealt with collateral and the fact that we said all collateral had to be recognized separately, even collateral that would meet the criteria for offsetting. We said go separate. And I think that was a mistake that we ought to be resolving, and the staff certainly has recognized that we ought to come forward and evaluate those items. The interesting question that I asked in the London Roundtable is if we really dealt with the collateral issue, how far along the continuum of issues with derivatives have we moved? And in private conversations afterwards, and one of the very big banks and other ones, they said that probably was the biggest issue. Not necessarily moving to credit risk netting sort of circumstance. So I think that's what we have to evaluate.
Guy, you asked that question in Norwalk. And when you asked it, as I recall, you also asked whether that meant if I had 100 on one side, 80 on the other, 20 collateral, am I 80, 80, or 0? And as I recall, you couldn't answer that question.
Yeah.
I think I could not speak for how I think we should answer that question. So I think that's a very key question that when we move through and discuss collateral and if they meet the offsetting, whether we do it on a contract-by-contract basis or are you able to offset collateral. An interesting issue is going to be, is it offset collateral if the two contracts that you have a net collateral position are settled on the same date? That's different than collateral that would be net settled, and you'd be settling those two contracts at different points in time. That's another issue that we've got to be able to deal with. But I do believe that the collateral issue is a very important issue that may help us, if we do it well, deal with a significant portion of the issues that were raised. That said, I can't see how going to full netting that we have in the United States creates a balance sheet number that makes sense to me. Because other than derivatives, the rest of the financial instruments I have on there are primarily at the amounts that you will pay on settlement. Okay, in due course, pay on settlement. Not on a conditional netting, it's the counterparty defaults. What you will pay on settlement. I don't understand how netting down to a credit risk position
that will occur conditionally on default added into the payment amounts you have in the other contracts get you to a total asset or liability number that make a lot of sense. If we were to net down collateral against the contract, if it meets the criteria, I think we end up again with a point where we'd be saying, what is the cash that you have to pay to settle the contract? In due course, you'd add that to the other financial instruments, and you'd get to a reasonable subtotal or total.
Warren?
Yeah. Similar to Tom, I guess my take is that apart from the feedback we got on simultaneous settlement and collateral, I don't think we've probably learnt too much that you would say, boy, I didn't think about that and I'll reconsider my decision. Interestingly, when you asked that question on collateral, you didn't necessarily get a straight answer, I might say, and you followed up in private. And I understand why you didn't get a straight answer at the time, but I think it was a very interesting response. But like Tom, I've not really heard anything that would change my mind, and I think going down the route of US GAAP at the moment doesn't produce information in the balance sheet that I think is understandable and representationally faithful. And so it's just interesting that people were feeding back to us the views that I think they've become comfortable with and familiar with over time based on practice that they've employed. So it's not surprising. I expected that that would be the case. I guess I was interested to get some feedback on those other issues, which I think were valid concerns and criticisms.
David, may I come in?
Yeah, okay, Pat.
I just wanted to say that I agree with what Paul and Warren and Tom have been saying. I think the conceptual framework clearly tells me that these numbers should be gross, and the feedback we received on the financial statement presentation project when we proposed to move some liabilities to the asset side was very negative from the preparers just generally, and I don't know why they think a linked approach at this time would be acceptable when they didn't like moving liabilities to the asset side in that case. But clearly there are some issues that we need to address in the ED proposal, collateral and simultaneous settlement, for example. But on balance, I support finalizing the ED.
Okay, thanks, Pat. I've got Pat, then Russ.
I support the ED as it was written, subject to, I guess, a couple of issues that I'm open to making modifications to, one of which is the one that Tom identified on simultaneous settlement. I think most people around the table would be open to that. That seems to deal with a very practical issue. I agree with Paul. It's very difficult for, I think, this board to support anything less than what we have in IS 32. But having said that, I've learned in 23 months that there is always a path to a compromise here, and one which I could actually live with while still preserving, I think, what's in IS 32. And that is, I think we've learned that as transactions are cleared through a central clearing party or on an exchange, there are instances where we can identify a net exposure at the end of any given day based on, you know, mark-to-market adjustments. And to the extent that net exposure is settled with a payment that's not representative of collateral, but a true payment, true settlement, and that may require some adjustments to the way contracts are written and the way central clearing parties operate, we could deliver what those people who are in favor of netting today want. What we need to do is give them time to get to that position. How long, I'm not sure, 2 or 3 years, to allow these central clearing parties to develop the changes in their processes and for these organizations to move what they have today in the form of bilateral and over-the-counter transactions onto central clearing party platforms. So there is a path forward here that I think could make most people happy. And in those markets where transactions continue to be reported or conducted, I should say, over the counter or on a bilateral basis, they, under this proposal, which I would support, would have to continue to report them on a gross basis. But I think there's a path forward that could solve a great deal of the concern around derivatives that would be prudent and I would think, acceptable.
Why do you call it a compromise?
Well, it wouldn't be the insistence on finalizing this standard today or tomorrow and say you have to use it. It would be a path forward to essentially adopting the key principles in here that would still fit with, I think, emerging business practice.
Okay. But to John's point, there would be an agreement as to what the principles were that had to be met in order to qualify for offsetting, and then it would be, you know, a matter of determining what effective date you would want on that document.
That's correct. I think approach four has the seeds of what I'm talking about embedded in it. So, yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. You would outline essentially the conditions that would need to be met when conducting transactions to a central clearing party, and I think it gives them essentially what these banks are looking for. But they have to be willing to move all that activity into that arena.
And I think you'd need to establish a fundamental objective, if you will, that those criteria would have to would be tailored to meet.
Agreed. Yep.
I had a question for Tom and Warren and maybe potentially Christian, and that is, what is your definition of a collateralized derivative? Is it, in the example that John talked about, where I have an asset position, I have a liability position, assets 100, liabilities 80, I require Tom to post collateral, so you post 16. You put as the asset, do you put 84 asset and 80 liability, or do you put 4 as an asset? So when you're talking about collateral, are you talking about only the posting of cash, or are you talking about the other derivatives within the master netting arrangement?
I think that's a decision we have to make as board members as to whether the conversations we had at the London Roundtable was there are certain collateral arrangements that meet the criteria for offsetting. I think those ought to be able to be offset. There are certain collateral arrangements that are tantamount to settlement. That's a derecognition issue to me. That isn't an offsetting issue. We should treat it as if they're settled, if it's legally enforceable settlement. Then we've got the issues where beyond those sorts of items, we have to decide unit of account issues on collateral. And it would depend to me in part on the timing of the two derivatives. If it was at the same time that the asset and liability would be settled and a net margin, for me, I would say if the net margin was on an asset liability that settled at the same time, I'd be able to feel if it meets the other criteria that we net it down. But if the margin was net settling and one derivative was going to be settled in a week and the other one in a year, I don't think you've effectively net offset that position. And that's what so it would be sort of combining, for me, part of the cash collateral plus notions of payment netting, which are the same date. So, but I think that's something that we certainly have to deliberate. That's part of the education session I'm sure Christian is suggesting. And I don't think the answers are perfectly easy or obvious, and we may end up disagreeing as board members.
Okay.
Yeah, from my perspective, when I look at one institution that's heavily engaged in derivative activities and another institution that also is, and one of them has taken the step of putting in place legally enforceable netting agreements that substantially eliminate the credit risk in the situation, and the other entity has not, I do not think they're in the same financial position. I think one has really put on what I'll call the ultimate hedge by making sure that in the event that there's a bankruptcy or something or a default, they are protected. And so, you know, some have made the point about the conceptual framework and how there's only one way to look at this. I guess when I take this same type of activity over to the hedging context, and I think about where the IASB is heading on the hedging proposal, I don't know why there's such a higher threshold for the netting on the balance sheet, in your view, than there is on the income statement. There, all you have to do is declare that you have a risk management strategy, make some designations, and there has to be an expectation of other than accidental offset. You have not even put legal agreements in place to ensure that that's in effect what's going to happen. So I find it very curious that, you know, on the netting, on this issue, when the parties have made their intent absolutely clear with legally enforceable agreements, we're not going to recognize that. But then you get to the hedging question where there's only declarations made with no commitment in a legal sense to do so, and that's going to be permitted. So I'd ask people to think about the thresholds we're using on these issues and whether those can be reconciled.
Okay, Howell and Philippe.
Great. Like Tom and others, I very much generally agree with what's in the document, except for the collateral issue. I don't think that was well thought through, as Tom put it. And I was more and more convinced as I sat through two of these roundtable discussions. The one thing I really had not gotten an answer to, and then Christian and Barbara, as they're putting together, you know, the education session to address, how, if we come to something that's agreeable to all the members in terms of what collateral is included and excluded, how will that change practice? And I think that's something that we really need to consider. I think, I don't know, as Walter or someone along this range said, you know, it'll take a couple of years, I think it was Pat, sorry, that, you know, said it'll take a couple of years. Is that in fact true, or will it be much quicker? My expectation was it was going to be, you know, a much shorter time frame. Practice would change, and not necessarily a bad thing. Either practice changes or certain products are eliminated because they frankly aren't carrying their weight, you know, if they're not covering their cost of capital, or however you want to measure it. So I would just ask you all to explore that particular issue. How will this change practice?
Philippe?
I'd like to ask Leslie a question. Instead of having two institutions, you have three. One has not established any settlement agreement. Two have. But among those two, one or two will settle net, and the other one will not settle net. Mm-hmm. Of course, from the risk perspective, having or not having such an agreement makes a big difference. So it justifies the disclosure of net positions in one case, not in the other one, because you cannot say I have a net exposure if you don't have such an agreement. But going back to Paul's point, is that the objective of financial statements to present net exposures or to present asset and liability positions which have a different liquidity, maybe, in terms of maturity? Among the two institutions which have put in place such an agreement, if there is an intention, an ability to set a net from a liquidity perspective, it's okay. Let's offset. If not, I don't think we should offset those positions, even though the risk exposure is nil. This is why, in my mind, the current U.S. gap, if I understand correctly, which doesn't look at the intention and ability to set a net, is broken. It's okay from a risk perspective, but not from a liquidity and from the conceptual standpoint that Paul mentioned.
Okay, any other comments?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Kevin.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of throw something out there. And let's face it, the biggest issue around this issue is derivatives. And probably repos. And I think, you know, what we heard, at least in the U.S. from a majority of investors, is that they prefer net. So to me, I guess that is some new information. So the way I think we should, the way I would propose we go forward with this is to start off with, okay, let's figure out what a model would be for all assets and liabilities except for derivatives and repos. Figure out what that model should be. And then look at derivatives by themselves. And say, okay, now do we want derivatives to be in that model? Is there something different about them that we should consider, such as the collateral issues, the settlement issues? And think about it independently of the main model so that we don't mix it together and say, well, we always have to end up with a model that would be consistent for all instruments. Maybe we could have some kind of small exception so we would treat collateral differently in situations where we have a master netting arrangement. And we know that master netting arrangements generally don't exist on other assets and liabilities. So I just throwing it out there that I think that we should think of things from a derivative standpoint by themselves and throw all the considerations in there, including the current U.S. GAAP model. Because I think what we heard from investors in a lot of cases is they like that model for derivatives when these certain things exist. So just to, I think, throw it aside and say, well, we're going to think of a thing as one big model, we could end up that way. I'm not saying we can't end up that way, but I think we should at least think of derivatives separately while we're going through this exercise, and then see where we land.
I think one other way to look at it is to say, well, this is the general criterion. Let's see whether there are any instances where it doesn't make sense. So instead of saying, well, it makes sense for these, but it doesn't make sense for that, you develop your criterion, and then you ask yourself, are there any instances where this criteria doesn't make sense? And if you can identify some like that, then you think about what do you do to address those points. As it stands right now, it's up to the boards to decide as to whether the criteria you have today, when you apply it to derivatives and repos and reverse repos, you get a right answer or not. But to the extent that you do get a right answer, then I don't think we should segregate the products into different components. They're going to change. Tomorrow there will be another product which might not be a derivative, it might be some strange product. Are we going to then develop a new offsetting criteria for that kind of product? To the extent that we don't think it doesn't work for a particular class of products, then I think we should have a consistent approach across, because products do change, contracts do change, and so it's better to have a principle in place. And then ask yourself, are there any instances where it doesn't work, rather than starting from the other way around and say, well, we're going to treat products differently.
I'm not sure I heard Kevin say something that was dramatically different than what you just said. I think he said, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought what he said was, let's start out and develop a set of principles, and then let's evaluate whether those principles work for derivatives and repos, and whether there's characteristics of those instruments are such, to use your words, Christian, that those general principles don't work or don't make sense. That's what I heard him say.
I think he was saying the other way around. He said we develop a principle for non-derivative transactions, and then we'll go back and see whether we can develop a different model. But we've not even established, first of all, whether the first model works for derivatives before you then consider whether. I think generally my recommendation to the boards will be that look at the principle that you have. Do you think today applying that principle to derivatives and repos and reverse repos will give you a misleading answer? If not, then I don't see why you should segregate products into different buckets and apply a different principle to them.
Go on.
One of the areas of this that bothers me is the master netting agreement. And I believe ISDA characterized that as a contract. If Philippe and I were counterparties and we agreed that we would enter into a swap, we would do some forward, and we'd do something else, and we put it in one contract and agreed at any point in time the exposure would be netted, so it's all in one. I think we'd say it's one contract. It seems to me, and we wouldn't be grossing the features up. Well, let's think of insurance. I can think of a lot of things where if it's all in one contract, the only thing you would show is the net exposure, because that's what the contract is. We don't gross up contract. But my point, more anything else, is I don't know why that isn't a contract, and if it isn't, then it would seem to me that I understand where we're at. But picking up on Pat's point, if it were a contract and that was changed in some way over time so it was clear, would we say that had to be gross? Now, Philippe is saying, yeah, I don't think we would if it was all a single contract.
But it's not a contract that's enforced today. It's an optional netting when the counterparty defaults. So we did say in that master netting agreement, ISDA, if they had payment netting, that in that contract caused the payments to be net on an ongoing basis, we would offset.
If I had a contract with, I don't want to do Philippe anymore. I'll do it with you. And it had two features. We had a swap in there, and we had a forward. And we agreed that every day we measure the fair values of those two features in the contract. And the net exposure is what one or the other would be liable for if we ever decided to settle, we could do it on a net basis. Would we gross that one up?
I think we would, but there's other implications, John.
You're jumping. Yeah. I started there, would we or wouldn't we? If we wouldn't, then my question is, if as Pat was suggesting, industry could do something to change their contracts in a way that it would satisfy our requirements, that to me is something that ought to be considered. That's all.
John, they would have to never settle those contracts separately outside of the master netting arrangement.
Well, I mean,
settle them net, never settle a commodity derivative separately, never settle a forward contract separately, never settle an option separately. That would be the effect of what you're saying.
Would you gross up my contract with Tom?
If you're going to settle them separately, no. I mean, yes.
Let me just comment on that. I think, John, it's a very... It's very hard to argue that where you have, I'll say, one instrument or one contract is the same as where you have two different contracts. Although maybe in aggregate, you might financially be in the same position. But the two different instruments and your legal rights might also be very different. And what might happen in a particular scenario, what you can do might be different as well. So it doesn't translate straight away that the fact that I have everything combined in one means because I'm going to treat that one contract as one instrument, I should necessarily treat all other contracts, which when you put together, gives me the same effect as also a single one.
I agree with you. But my point more than anything else was if it was a contract and it had different features, I'll make it even simpler. I got a swap. You pay me fixed on Monday. I pay you variable on Friday. We wouldn't gross that up. We would on Monday when you owe it to me. But in between, we just measure the fair value.
Right.
So now I added another feature into the contract. I don't think we'd net it. We would gross it up as long as it was one contract between us. So the only point I was making, the master netting, the industry or ISDA argued it's a contract. We didn't buy into that. So... is there something they could do to change whatever they're doing to say we got a contract and we think of it differently?
But, John, where would you stop? That's my question that you don't want
to ask. I agree with somebody who said, why would we have a different set of criteria for the same thing? And so I'm asking. I'm not promoting an idea one way or the other. I'm just asking if it was a single contract and we would look at it net.
I'll ask you another way then,
okay.
So that I'm not locking you in. Are you thinking that if we were convinced that it was one contract, so you combined these things with the master netting agreement varied, whatever you need to do to convince us it's one contract, would you then change the way, for example, would you use that just for thinking about netting and offsetting, or would you follow it through so that, for example, when you came to hedge accounting and you have to use an entire derivative to... as your hedging instrument, that you'd have to use that entire contract as well, or would you be
able to pull it apart? Absolutely. No exceptions, particularly for hedging.
Also, John, if I may ask you a question, what will happen when you enter into, so you started with an equity swap or an equity option, and then you entered into an interest rate swap. So now the instrument that you... it's one contract, but you agree to modify it to add some features to it because that's the way you run the business because you enter into transactions as you go forward. And hence, you modify the agreement and you add some few paragraphs to it, which basically allows you to have an interest rate swap in there. Are you also going to de-recognize what you had before and then do your redesignation for hedge accounting all over again because you have a new thing, it's a new instrument? And then also, in addition to that,
let me ask the first question. it won't matter because I'd be at fair value. But go ahead.
Well, the P&L will not matter because you are in a fair value world. But what about the hedge relationship? Because the instrument that you have is a different instrument. So you de-recognize the instrument that you had before. Now you have a new instrument. So you have to go through the process again to do it and then measure your effectiveness and the rest of it.
Seems to me I terminated the hedge if I terminated the contract.
That is if it's
the only point I'm making is if it was you and I with the transaction, whatever features we put in there, we'd evaluate on the value of the contract. Just the way we do insurance, and I'm not picking on insurance. There's a lot of things flying around, but we say look at it at the contract.
That's it.
Thank you, David. Can I ask a question about the net settlement of the net presentation of the derivatives? So, say that I'm not quite clear in that notion. So, obviously, derivative itself is a sort of the value of net, especially in the case of swaps. So cash flow is totally different, but net. So, but net of derivatives is not that net. That means, two net or gross is a paying leg and a receiving leg. Then whether it should be grossed up or net, that is not the issue, I think. Within one portfolio, and if I have the several derivatives with the same counterparty, it should be treated as a net. That is the notion of the net, what you are talking about?
I think, thanks, Tasumi, for the clarification. What we're talking about here is how do you present individual transactions, whether you present them net or not. But as to how you account for a particular transaction, you've already made that decision today, that if it doesn't matter how the flows when you pay and how much you have to exchange and when you're going to exchange. To the extent that it's one contract under IS39 today and even under US GAAP, you present it as one derivative, one instrument. But what the project is about is where you have different instruments. And the question then becomes, when do you present them net? The default position, based on Warren and Paul said, your default position is that you present assets and liabilities. And so the question then becomes, is there a justifiable reason that you should present two or more items net on the face of the balance sheet?
I'm a little bit confused. So in case of swap, obviously, in one transaction, it's a paying leg and receiving leg. It's not the issue.
That's not the issue.
Okay. So derivative itself has a net value, obviously, and transaction is done by that basis. So and the netting of the netting presentation of derivatives is if I have a swap and the currency, derivatives, it should be net if the counterparty is the same.
Well, it's to some extent it's a unit of account issue too, though, because now if you have this master netting arrangement that John was talking about, that's what would bring those two contracts together to be basically considered maybe potentially one contract. So now it becomes a unit of account. So is the unit of account that one contract, or is the unit of account those two individual instruments? That's, I think, some of the issues that John is bringing up.
But is it a contract?
Is it even a contract? If you conclude it's a contract, then you've got to decide from a unit account perspective, am I going to account for the contract or the two individual instruments? So it's not as simple as you're making it out to be, I don't think.
But I think...
I'm so simple-minded, but... I try to clarify that, say, Kevin, what you suggested is we have a general principles, but say for derivatives, we must have exceptions. I would like to know that.
I wasn't saying we must have exceptions. All I was saying is that we could look at derivatives separately to determine whether the guidance should be or should not be the same. That's all I was saying. And I didn't say we can come up with a different guidance. I'm just saying we should give it the special attention that I think it deserves in this project and not just sweep it under the rug as being another asset or liability.
What I would like to know is why we need a different special, say, principles or exceptions for derivatives. That is not clear to me.
Because of the master netting arrangement that could potentially be considered a contract to bring those other things together. That's why. I wouldn't do it if the master netting arrangement wasn't associated with it. So that's what I'm saying. You have to have a bunch of conditions around it.
Answer. So
ask them whether that changes the unit of account.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're a friend of John.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make a point. I think we're dragging ourselves back a bit because unless you're going to go back today to change I-39 and the equivalent FAS-133, then I don't see why that becomes an argument because you've already determined the unit of account anyway. And you did that when you have masternet agreements in place. And when you develop I-39, and since I-39 has been in place, masternet agreements have been in place. And hence, are you saying that when you were developing that, you didn't take masternet agreements in place in determining the unit of account? You've already done that. The question now is, how do you move forward? You have these separate, you've already determined that they are separate items. But how do we present them going forward? I think that's the question. And we should not miss the two.
But you could consider a unit of account from a presentation perspective and not necessarily from a measurement perspective. And I think is what, right, and which is what FIN 39 does now for derivatives.
I think the issue of whether we consider derivatives separately is that unless you have a reason why you think derivatives are special and hence they deserve a special treatment, then I don't see why we should carve out repos and derivatives today to find a new way of addressing them. I'm not convinced that they're different from any other instrument. I'm not convinced that the guidance you've developed cannot be applied to them. I'm not convinced that you have a unit of account issue because you've already determined that, unless you want to go back and revisit your derivative guidance.
Well, I think the reason this issue has come up a few times is that, in fact, the basis for conclusions for FIN 39 was that the master netting agreement, when it meets all the criteria that are laid out in that standard, does effectively merge the contractual rights of the parties. So I think it may not have convinced you, but it convinced the board at the time.
I guess I, as one board member, would like to look at it further to understand whether there are specific business practices and the details of the master netting, et cetera, in order to evaluate whether there are circumstances, or special circumstances, that would merit them being treated differently. Okay, I did learn some things in meetings with various people that caused me to pause and think about the position that I took, all right, which was clearly influenced by the desire to move forward on convergence. But at the same time, I have some questions in my mind about that, which is one of the reasons why I'm particularly enamored with the suggestion of Pat and John. So, you know, if you're asking for board member views, this is one board member that would like to look at it further so I can learn from it and make a better judgment.
Okay, I'm going to close this shortly, Amaro.
Thanks, Dave. I think just a few comments. First of all, I agree we must have only one principle that applies to everything. The way I see the netting agreement is a contract. It's not enforceable in the same way all over the world. It's an umbrella contract that provides a conditional right to net under specific, if something specifically occurs, generally the bankruptcy contract. So I think if we develop a principle that applies to every sort of contract, assets and liabilities, this will be applied as well to derivatives. And it's also, of course, we can continue exploring derivatives as a part of educational process, but we should acknowledge that in many jurisdictions there are other contracts that might be similar to netting agreements and apply to other sorts of assets and liabilities as well. It could be a deposit, could be linked to a loan. Escrow accounts are used in many jurisdictions. So I guess if we start to explore and try to understand more from the netting agreements that we didn't learn until now, we might end up with, again, in the same principle. This is the only way to pursue one model that applies to every asset and liability.
Okay, we have to decide how to go forward. I don't think we're ready to do any sort of type of vote on what we think the eventual outcome should be. I didn't get the impression from the general discussions that the exposure draft would simply be a shoo-in. Everyone felt it was perfect and we should just go forward on that basis. We heard quite a bit about the issues of the simultaneous settlement. Tom mentioned that, and also the fact of the collateral. So do you think that at least is something we should explore? There's going to be one or two other things I might suggest, but do we agree we should explore that? The second thing is, I think, having heard Leslie, Larry and so on, they really want to know more about the difference between a specific contract and what Amaro called an umbrella contract. You know, we should look at why FASB came up years ago with what they did, and how does that fit in. I haven't heard many people talk about linked contracts. If we do that, the link approach, the presentation approach, I should say, not linked contracts. If we do that, we have to explore why these ones and not non-recourse finance or something like that. We'd have to differentiate between these things. Otherwise, there's a whole lot of things could be swept under, not just under that basis. So what would you like to explore? I presume nobody really feels we should vote right here and now, do they? Well, that's a strong hint, but... Right, well, that's... Okay, but then other people want to know about the umbrella contract versus the specific. So I think it's incumbent on us to look at that.
I think from the staff's perspective, we want very clear direction so that we know what to bring to you. If you tell the staff that you're happy with the proposal subject to these issues being addressed, and you still retain the right to throw the whole thing out tomorrow, but and then it gives us a direction as to how we can then prepare papers and analysis for your consideration. And if you want to know more about a particular aspect, i.e. derivatives, applying the model to derivatives, we can also look into that. But with a very clear direction, we'll struggle to meet any deadline that you might have in mind.
That's it.
I'm not quite clear, say, what you have asked.
I'm trying to find what the board's view is. That's
oh, no. I would like to clarify what questions is. So that means, ED is obviously that sort of the case where, in order to offset, we must have unconditional rights and obligations. So what you're suggesting is that based on that, we should go forward and say some concerns which are raised by the constituents should be dealt with. So that is what you're asking us to answer.
That's certainly one thing. I think we have to look at the concerns that were expressed, and that was the two specific ones that came to mind were the simultaneous settlement issue and also the question of the collateral. Mm-hmm. So we would look at that. So that's one thing to do, and that's on the assumption we go ahead with the ED plus that. Now, the next question is there something else you want to do? Larry and Leslie have said that we ought to really look at why some see the netting agreement as a form of umbrella contract, and it therefore should be considered in the same way. Others might disagree. But the question is, do we ask the staff to do that as well?
Didn't do at the HDD stage. Yeah. I presume that analysis was done, wasn't it?
Well, this is the nature of the question I raised to Tom and Warren. And I think what I heard you say was you need this analysis to determine what you mean by collateral. Because Tom says, I don't know, he thinks it's a legitimate thing for the board to debate. I agree. But if you find that the master net arrangements are legally enforceable, if you find that a lot of the derivatives settle within a relatively short period of time because the reason the derivatives are there is to, in essence, close out another derivative position. They don't close it out. They enter into an opposite derivative position. That might lead somebody to believe that the master netting arrangement is a form of collateral in some cases. In other cases, it might be always a form of collateral. So it seems to me we've got to do the analysis to determine
what is the definition of collateral?
Can't we determine a principle based on how collateral can be used based on what we think the offsetting, you know, principle should be? And if the master netting arrangement fits into that based on people's use of it, then they can apply the master netting arrangement to those principles.
But without knowing what people do today, it's hard to do the cost-benefit analysis to answer that question. Because you've got users that, when both in the U.S. users and international users, there is not one clear message as to what users want gross or net. So in order to understand the cost, you've got to, without a clear benefit, you've got to understand the magnitude of the change. Either way, you've got significant international banks that want netting. You've got significant U.S. banks that want to retain netting. So to me, you've got to go through this exercise to be able to complete the project.
I think the collateral discussions could address that question.
Okay, can I just want to add to it? I think I'm not sure whether the issue is master netting agreements or collateral. Because you have collateral on our central counterparties, you have collateral when it comes to master netting agreements, you have collateral with many legal financial contracts. And so how are you going to treat collateral in general is a broader question than master netting agreements. Mm-hmm. But if you want to look into master netting agreements, I believe we did that. There was a nice session that most of you attended. We had lawyers here talking to you about master netting agreements, what they do and what they're supposed to do. There are many papers that the staff prepared for you in the past, setting out what the various pieces of the master netting framework trying to achieve. And so I think based on all that discussion, all those discussions, you made a decision to go forward in a particular way. And the question that I think we probably need to address ourselves is, did you get it right? Are there any issues that you need to look into the particular approach that you propose, or you want to just dump the approach you propose and do something different?
Or in the first instance, there's another suggestion to move forward. Is it? I think one of the issues we had in the ED was this term collateral, such a broad term that encompasses a massive range of things. Is it helpful for the staff to bring back an analysis of the different types of collateral,
absolutely,
how they work in conjunction with the positions, and then we can think about which types of collateral meet the criteria in the ED, and we can think about what other types of criteria they are and what the implications would be of incorporating them, how that would modify the criteria, and think about the spectrum and what we think is useful information. And then I think, at least partly, some of these master netting agreements are going to be associated with these collateral arrangements, so we can start thinking about it in that context in the first instance. And then at least we've got a bit more of an idea of what the criteria are that we're working toward, and a bit more thorough understanding of what these different collateral arrangements are, what they mean in terms of settlement as a matter of law, what they mean in terms of liquidity, and we can think it through a bit more thoroughly and do that as the first step rather than leaping to master netting agreements just as a... Because also to Amaro's concept, it's not necessarily that it's got master netting agreement written at the top, it's what's the effect of that arrangement on what's going on.
But a lot of cases, this collateral is conditional. So if we're going to stick with unconditionals being the main driver, then it doesn't matter what we could bring back with you from a collateral standpoint. If it's conditional, it's never going to fit within the model. And that's the point I was trying to make, to say we've got to think about it just beyond the existing model sometimes.
Exactly. Which is why I think if we look at the spectrum, we can look at what part of the spectrum fits with the original criteria. Then we can think about the other.